Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
So for many reasons, I find this an apt moment for a conference that's considering the passions. Let me just focus on one for a moment. Rapid advances in artificial intelligence. Claims by Blake Lemoine in summer 2022 that Google's large language model Lambda was conscious were followed by the release of ChatGPT late in 2022, catapulting artificial intelligence to the forefront of attention overnight. There were concerns, of course, about students using ChatGPT to cheat, and concerns about everyone from screenwriters to legal aides being put out of their jobs. And there were yet more fundamental concerns and anxieties. Lambda is not actually conscious. Pretty much everyone agrees on that. But might AI become conscious someday? Might artificial general intelligence, capable of human-like intelligence across multiple domains, be within reach? What of artificial superintelligence, exceeding human intellectual capacities? Rapid advances in machine intelligence are posing anew questions concerning human distinctiveness and feeding anxieties, or among some transhumanists, enthusiasm, not just about the disappearance of certain job sectors, but about human replacement more generally. For a long time, we humans have prided ourselves on our cognitive capacities, but now these are being exceeded in one domain after another. And the fact that it is our own creations that are leaving us in the dust is cold comfort, particularly given the possibility that they might someday become autonomous, no longer subject to our control or catering to our desires. Small wonder, then, that this AI moment has triggered intensified interest in fundamental questions of philosophical and theological anthropology. One of the boons of this renewed attention to the human in the context of AI is that it offers an opportunity to remind ourselves that, contrary to Hobbes, say, human intelligence is not merely a form of calculation. We are rational animals, after all, finite, embodied intelligences. An algorithm just calculates. Nothing matters to it. A large language model just spits out words statistically most likely to follow in a given sequence. But all sorts of things, people, and ideas matter to us humans. We care about them. Our capacity to care is rooted in our organic vulnerability. As we encounter increasingly sophisticated simulations of caring from AI, it becomes increasingly important that we understand the character of real caring and its organic nature. This is one of the strengths of the Aristotelian tradition to which Thomas belongs. It recognizes that we cannot be perfected as the kind of creatures that we are without reckoning with all the many dimensions bound up with being this sort of creature. And the passions are one key element of our creaturely being. Inconvenient as the passions can sometimes be, so inconvenient that the Stoics, along with many thinkers since, have sought to banish them, they are part and parcel of what it means to be human. Aquinas, of course, did not have the category of machine intelligence with which to contrast human cognition. He did, though, think a great deal about what differentiated angelic from human intelligence and about what differentiated human from non-human animals, and what he had to say can illuminate our reflection today. I want to focus my talk this morning on the passion of anger. Its place as one of the reactive emotions influentially analyzed by the philosopher Peter Strawson, and the role of this passion in practices of responsibility holding. Anger has cognitive dimensions that link it up with justice, and Aquinas clearly identifies these cognitive dimensions. He also recognizes that other animals, too, feel a passion of anger. Anger thus becomes a vital site for examining the embodied animal dimensions of an ethical practice like holding responsible which is so distinctively human. Strawson's reactive attitudes or reactive emotions. Oh, by the way, you have a handout. I'm not going to refer to it, but if you look at it, you'll see how I'm moving through it. Maybe it'll be helpful. So Strawson's reactive attitudes or reactive emotions are emotions that we feel toward others insofar as we are bound up together with them in webs of interpersonal relationship. Our reactive attitudes reveal the expectations that we have of others and how they will act toward us. Strawson was particularly interested in the reactive attitude of resentment, noting that if someone steps on my hand while trying to, say, help me out of a tight spot, the physical pain may be no less than if that person were to step on my hand out of spite. However, in the latter instance, I will be disposed to feel a resentment that would not be present in the former. When we feel resentment, we are disposed to blame someone, to summon them, to acknowledge the wrong that they have done to another. Strawson argued that we could make sense of responsibility by attending to acts of holding responsible, and by understanding the activity of holding responsible in terms of being disposed to adopt particular reactive attitudes toward others. We feel resentment only under certain circumstances that have to do with the violation of social expectations. Debates over whether another agent is a proper target of responsibility have to do with whether it is appropriate to adopt particular reactive attitudes, notably resentment, toward that agent. Now, anger is clearly a reactive emotion. Strawson also mentions gratitude, forgiveness, reciprocal love, and hurt feelings. He considers all of these to be attitudes that belong specifically to involvement or participation with others in interpersonal human relationships. They reveal the expectations that we have of others and how they will act toward us. They are to be contrasted with objective attitudes, which we do at times take up toward one another. Quoting from Strawson, we look with an objective eye on the compulsive behavior of the neurotic or the tiresome behavior of a very young child, thinking in terms of treatment or training. When we do this, we treat the other in a behaviorist fashion, as an object of manipulation, or perhaps in the case of someone who is deranged, hostile, and very strong, as a force to be understood and controlled, fought, or fled. We suspend ordinary interpersonal engagement in these situations. We suspend ordinary expectations of others and ordinary reactions to others' good or ill will. What is the difference between anger and resentment? Both are reactive emotions, and both are responses to violations of social expectations that we have of others. Both seem to be very closely associated with blame and responsibility. Well, I'm going to leave that question hanging for now. I will return to it a bit later. But I want first to turn to Aquinas' analysis of anger. And I'm very grateful that the talks were ordered in a wonderful fashion, so I can just say, remember the handout from yesterday. So anger for Thomas is one of the irascible passions. The passions as such draw us toward what appears good and away from that which appears evil. They reside in the appetitive power, specifically in the sensitive appetite, and they belong to us insofar as we are in potentiality. God has no passions, since God is fully actual. The angels have no passions, since passions involve bodily transmutation, bodily change. The passions are something we share with other animals. Like us, other animals are in potentiality. Like us, they are corporeal. Like us, they are drawn by the sensitive appetite toward apparent goods and away from apparent evils. Since love is one of the passions, Aquinas must account for how it is that we can properly say that God loves, even though God has no passions. Humans can love by way of an intellectual appetite and not merely by way of a sensitive appetite. When we do so, this is a simple act of the will without passion and without any alteration in the body, and we discussed this yesterday. This is how we are properly united to divine things by love, and it gives us some grasp of how it is that God, in whom there is no alteration at all, nevertheless loves. Aquinas fully appreciates the way in which the passions function to enable animals to act in ways that allow them to flourish and to be perfected as the sorts of creatures that they are. This flows from his Aristotelian understanding of the teleological character of living organisms. A robin, for instance, perceives worms, straw, and baby robins as good. Worms in the mode of being tasty, straw in the mode of suitable building materials for a nest, and baby robins in the mode of needing food and care. In eating worms, building nests, and feeding baby robins, the robin is following its passions, which are generally reliable pointers to those things through which its specific good as a robin is realized. We can say that the passions are good for animals since they direct them toward the realization of their flourishing. We can't, though, consider these passions as morally good or evil, since moral good and evil depend for Aquinas on the will. Since the passions can be subject to the command of reason and will in humans, they can become morally good or evil. They can, that is, become voluntary and subject to assessment as such, as that for which a moral agent is responsible. Think of it this way. If the robin starts to eat seeds instead of worms, we assume that something about the robin's passions has become defective. Seeds rather than worms now appear tasty, even though they are not healthy for robins to eat. We do not, though, lay this defect to the robin's account. We don't hold the robin responsible for its defective eating habits. And this remains the case even if the robin starts to feed its babies seeds instead of worms and thereby harms them. The robin's actions are not subject to the command of reason and will, and the robin is therefore not properly held accountable for them. The robin is defective. It is not vicious or evil. In humans, the passions can go awry by becoming defective in the same sort of way as a robin's passions. For instance, if through some sort of neurological disorder, I begin to have an urge to eat gravel. But the passions can also fail to follow will and reason and go awry in a distinctively human way. Aquinas is clear that we should not wish ourselves devoid of the passions. They are part and parcel of who we are. It belongs to the perfection of moral good, he says, that man should be moved unto good, not only in respect of his will, but also in respect of his sensitive appetite. Ideally, the passions harmonize with reason's judgments and work in accord with the will's rational pursuit of the good. When this is the case, we are able more easily to act in accordance with reason, finding it easy and pleasant to do so. And it is under these circumstances that the passions can be said to be morally good. Thomas divides the passions into two classes, the concupiscible and the irascible. And the object of the concupiscible power is sensible good or evil, simply apprehended as such. Sensible good causes pleasure, and sensible evil causes pain. And again, think of the table from yesterday. The object of the irascible power, by contrast, is sensible good or evil, inasmuch as it is arduous or difficult. I won't take the time here to unpack the basis on which Aquinas differentiates all the various passions from one another. It's enough for present purposes simply to note anger's distinctive place in this taxonomy of the passions. Aquinas considers the concupiscible passions to be desire, aversion, joy, sorrow, love, and hatred, while the irascible passions are daring, fear, hope, despair, and anger. Anger is distinct from all of the other passions in not being paired with any contrary. Whereas a difficult good not yet obtained and considered as good draws us to itself through hope, and considered as difficult elicits despair, and an arduous evil as shunned elicits fear, but when it is addressed elicits daring, anger is caused by a difficult evil that is already present. Aquinas also takes note of the distinctive cognitive character of anger, explaining that anger in a fashion requires an act of reason. In order to grasp this, and this is why last night Steve Jensen said anger and non-human animals don't have anger because of the act of reason. But I think it's a complex thing. So anger in a fashion, Aquinas says, requires an act of reason. In order to grasp this, we must first unpack the eliciting conditions of the passion of anger. The movement of anger, Thomas explains, does not arise save on account of some pain inflicted, and unless there be desire and hope of revenge. As he goes on, it becomes clear that anger arises not from the infliction of pain as such, but from perceived injury. I don't become angry with a phlebotomist drawing my blood, even if the needle causes pain, or at least not as long as the phlebotomist appears to be acting professionally and exercising due care. Not all pain inflicted amounts to injury, and our passionate responses differentiate between the two. The passion of anger also distinguishes between intentionally and accidentally inflicted injury. And here's Thomas again. If we think that someone has done us an injury through ignorance or through passion, either we are not angry with them at all, or very much less, since to do anything through ignorance or through passion diminishes the notion of injury, and to a certain extent calls for mercy and forgiveness. A comment that would ordinarily be understood as disrespectful, thus eliciting our anger, may be calmly tolerated from a foreign visitor or a young child. So anger involves a desire and a hope of revenge. This is not merely a reflex response to pain, since, as we've just seen, anger is elicited not by pain, but rather by perceived injury. What anger seeks is specifically the vindication of justice. Injury violates justice, and revenge or vengeance, vindicatio, seeks to restore justice. The cognitive dimensions of anger are thus brought into relief. In order to feel anger, we must judge that we have not merely been harmed, but injured. And anger is directed toward another agent taken as appropriate object of retribution through which justice will be restored. Now, vengeance, comments Aquinas, implies a comparison between the punishment to be inflicted and the hurt done. Now, to compare and to draw an inference is an act of reason. Therefore, anger in a fashion requires an act of reason. The fact that anger has these cognitive dimensions, that it requires an act of reason, at least in a fashion, creates a puzzle. If it is puzzling that God can love in the absence of passions, here the puzzle comes from the opposite direction. The passions are something that we possess insofar as we are animals, corporeal creatures drawn by our sensitive appetites toward apparent goods and away from apparent evils. In irrational animals, the sensitive appetite does not obey reason. If it did, they would be rational, not irrational animals. But how then can irrational animals feel anger? Strangely enough, it might seem that at least some of the passions, those like anger and gratitude that are predicated on certain judgments, are out of the reach of other animals, even as the passions are a characteristic feature of the animal form of life. Aquinas's answer to this puzzle is to point to instinct. Dumb animals have a natural instinct imparted to them by the divine reason, he writes, in virtue of which they are gifted with movements both internal and external, like unto rational movements. So by virtue of divinely implanted natural instinct, an animal can become angered at injury, even though incapable of drawing any conscious distinction between harm an injury, or between intentional or unintentional action. And Aquinas also speaks of an estimative power, which plays something of the role of practical reason in non-human animals. The estimative power is subject to divine reason and lends to the passions of irrational animals a certain likeness of moral good. Now, talk of instinct has fallen out of scientific favor, as researchers now aspire to offer more granular accounts of animal cognition and behavior. But current empirical research supports Aquinas' observation that there are non-human animals that display the passion of anger and that its characteristic cognitive dimensions are indeed visible. One of the primary contexts in which this has been studied is in the context of so-called social inequity studies. In a much-discussed series of experiments carried out by Sarah Brosnan and Franz de Waal, Capuchin monkeys trained to exchange tokens for food refused to do this if they witnessed a partner in the neighboring cage receive a preferred food, a strawberry or a grape, in exchange for a token, while they themselves were given the less preferred piece of cucumber. In fact, they frequently threw the cucumber back at the experimenter rather than eating it, despite the fact that they ordinarily were quite content to eat cucumber. Have some of you seen the videos of these experiments? Yeah. Experimental subjects who refused to participate when a partner received a better reward did not refuse to participate in a non-social condition. That is, you're the only one in a cage. You're the only one being offered anything. You just take the cucumber. But there's somebody next to you getting the grape. They're like, no way, I'm not going to take the cucumber. It has also been shown that both capuchins and chimpanzees will refuse to continue participating in token exchanges when their own outcome is repeatedly worse than that of a partner. In addition, capuchins ceased cooperating in a retrieval task if one partner was able to claim all of the rewards. Inequity aversion appears to be characteristic of species that live in relatively small, stable social groups in which cooperation between unrelated individuals is frequent. Inequity aversion is thus thought to have evolved as a support for cooperation, helping to guard against exploitation of one partner by another. Consistent with this hypothesis, chimpanzees are willing to collaborate for unequal rewards as long as these are traded off over time and inequities are not persistent. Inequity aversion requires certain cognitive capacities. It requires a capacity to recognize individuals and to retain a memory of interactions. It doesn't, though, need to involve self-conscious awareness or articulated judgment. There need be no thought that the experimenter is unfair or I am being injured, exploited, taken advantage of. Such judgments require language. They require symbolic thought. There are, however, social expectations present in these creatures that, when violated, give rise to anger. These are social expectations that we language users recognize as having to do with justice. We can say that these animals feel and respond to injury, even though they cannot make judgments concerning injury. They differentiate between harms that result from accident or natural forces and those that are brought about intentionally. They are, for instance, more tolerant of harms that are inflicted by juveniles as opposed to adults. In all of these ways, their anger responses track justice in the same way that human anger responses do. The flash of anger that we feel when hit on the head evaporates when we see that the branch fell from a tree rather than being hit by the person behind us. And just the same pattern of differentiated response is observable in our primate neighbors. These observations open the door to perceiving a broad array of implicit social norms and expectations among highly social animals. Some of these have to do with possession. Among chimpanzees and also several monkey species, a dominant individual will not usually attempt to take food that's currently in the possession of another, even a subordinate member of the group. Rather, they beg for the food instead of taking it by force, even when they could certainly command it just by virtue of their physical strength. Similar norms concerning possession are apparent in some species of birds. Macaques can recruit third-party support by screaming if another individual attempts to take food from them. That there are social penalties for such behaviors indicates that they are experienced by victims as adverse events, even as violations. And that the norm is for the most part respected indicates that there is effective awareness of this fact. Even though this is not taking the form of explicit recognition of and respect for a norm as such. Macaques that respond to a theft from a fellow are undoubtedly aroused by the victim's screams, but they also grasp that the thing to be done in responding is to assist the victim of the theft, rather than, say, assist the thief. Powerful evidence of third-party recognition of a norm of possession. Other social norms govern play. During play, it's expected that individuals will not seek to hurt, eat, or mate with their play partner or partners. Studies of coyotes have shown that cheaters, those that bite too hard or play too roughly, are shunned. Dogs that do not play fair may be actively chased out of playgroups. Mark Beckhoff and Jessica Pierce argue that when animals play, they must agree to play. They must cooperate and behave fairly. Further, when fairness breaks down, play not only stops, it becomes impossible. Unfair play is an oxymoron. Shunning and partner switching are perhaps the most widespread social consequences of the violation of norms. Active punishment is less common, but there are interesting examples. Cleaner fish, for example, work in pairs, and when one cheats by eating a bit of the fish that's supposed to be cleaning, the partner punishes it. Chimpanzees, too, have been shown to engage in punishment-like behavior. In a laboratory study, chimpanzees who were able to punish theft of food from themselves did so. They were also more likely to deprive a thief of food than deprive a fellow chimpanzee to whom a third party had given the food. So they appear to differentiate between unequal gifts which violate no social expectations, when a third party gives to one and not to another, or gives unequally, and theft which does violate expectations, when a fellow steals food over which they themselves previously had control. The maintenance of social norms in other animals is not always mediated by the social passion, such as anger, but anger serves this purpose quite effectively. Of course, Aquinas is quick to point out that even in humans, anger does not always properly seek justice. On his account, anger does not always listen perfectly to reason. In particular, it doesn't observe the rule of reason as to the proper measure of vengeance. Anger seeks vengeance, punishment. It seeks to hurt the one who has done injury. And anger is often excessive. It easily becomes vindictive rather than being vindicative of justice. So on Thomas's account, anger both requires an act of reason and it also hinders reason. We need the virtues so that passions like anger support rather than working at odds with reason's judgments. As I mentioned at the outset, in his account of the reactive emotions, Peter Strawson places particular emphasis on the emotion of resentment, linking it with a disposition to blame others and summon them to acknowledge the wrongs they have inflicted on others. I have focused on the emotion of anger. It's now time to circle back to the question of the difference between anger and resentment. Are they just one and the same? Here, I think, a distinction recently introduced by Stephen Darwall between the second personal attitudes of the will and the second personal attitudes of the heart can provide helpful clarity. Both are attitudes that we have toward others insofar as we stand in relationship with them. They are reactive in Strawson's terms, or second personal in Darwall's terms. Where second personal attitudes of the will, such as respect, resentment, and guilt, presuppose that both parties share in the capacity and authority to ask one another for reasons, second personal attitudes of the heart, such as love, anger, and remorse, presuppose that both share the capacity for and worthiness of emotional connection. Both are essentially reciprocating, attitudes of the will and attitudes of the heart. But where attitudes of the will seek accountability, attitudes of the heart seek heartfelt connection. Second personal attitudes of the will are distinctively human in that they require the use of language and with it the capacity to act for and to exchange reasons. But while Darwall doesn't say this, I think that it is clear that second personal attitudes of the heart are not distinctively human. They are shared by other highly social animals who are similarly capable of heartfelt connection to others that seeks reciprocation. Anger is a second personal attitude of the heart. It flares up in the Capuchin experiments because a second personal relationship has been established between the human experimenter and the monkeys. This relationship establishes expectations and is attended by various emotional susceptibilities. Personal anger, Darwall says, seeks to direct the other's attention to what matters to the angry person in the hope that it will matter to the other precisely because the angry person matters to them, that is, that they care. Neither in the case of humans nor of other primates is this ordinarily a self-conscious process. We're not the only animals that distinguish bad luck from malice, intentional from unintentional harm and respond to intentional harm through the expression of anger. Like our own reactive attitudes in other animals, too, these are backward-looking evaluative responses. I mean, it could be that they potentially function prospectively to mold the future behavior of the target. This is not their proximate cause any more than our own resentment of others is a tactic to manipulate or behavioristically shape their future activity. What of anger at harm to someone else, to a cared-for other? As we've seen, third parties intervene in response to aggression on the part of freeloaders in experiments on chimpanzee cooperation. Moreover, the alpha male rushes to the defense of females and subordinate males under attack by a rival. Anger at harm or aggression directed at close social associates, at kins, at friends, at allies, appears to be quite common. This, too, is a second personal attitude of the heart that humans share with other highly social animals. Anger differs from resentment, the corresponding second personal attitude of the will, in that resentment calls for accountability, for acknowledgement that a wrong has been done to the other. Committing, identifying, and acknowledging wrongs requires the capacity to give reasons, to give an account. Language makes it possible for our reactions to be articulated, to be made explicit. It allows for the formation of recursive judgments, of judgments about judgments. And this, in turn, makes it possible for us to differentiate between our emotional reactions and the judgments that those emotional reactions embody, and thus also to ask whether the judgments are accurate and the emotional reactions justified. We can then recognize that it is proper to target another with a particular reactive attitude only if they are worthy of that response, and to name the indispensable material conditions for fulfilling responsibilities. It becomes possible, too, not merely to have an epistemic expectation of another that they will act in certain ways, but also a deontic expectation of someone to do or refrain from doing various things. With this deontic expectation, we enter into the territory of second personal attitudes of the will. Attitudes of the will concern what we can legitimately expect of one another, not merely what we can expect from them or predict of them, and thus that for which we can legitimately call them to account. There are contexts in which only second personal attitudes of the will are expected or desired, as in many impersonal settings. In the context of close personal relationships, though, it can be deeply disturbing if a partner displays only attitudes of the will and not those of the heart. Where one seeks heartfelt connection, having another acknowledge having wronged you without showing any pain of remorse can be painful evidence that heartfelt connection is missing. As Darwall notes, respect is powerless to heal any emotional hurt or heart sickness. Only love can heal a broken heart. On the other hand, in relating to young infants and those with severe dementia, it could be that the reactive attitudes of the will are suspended. Very often, though, both kinds of reactive attitudes are present and interacting in complex ways. Important as second personal attitudes of the will are to human responsibility practices, without second personal attitudes of the heart, they are a hollow shell. Agent responsibility is understandably often regarded as a distinctively human capacity. Yet second personal attitudes of the heart, such as love and anger, are as important for sustaining human responsibility practices as are second personal attitudes of the will, such as guilt and resentment. We share with other social animals in a world sustained through the former, through social expectations and heartfelt connections that weave and reweave our social fabric. Practices of responsibility, starting with second personal attitudes of the heart, work to knit us together in communities of shared expectation and response. Without the forms of ethical agency we share with other animals, we would be insensitive to value. We would not care about ourselves, one another, or the world, or care about fairness or the just ordering of our common lives. The norms, practices, and institutions that we create can flourish only insofar as they remain in touch with and fed by these affect-based modes of access to the good. In order to become the kind of agents capable of reflectively being for the good, we humans, like other social animals, first need secure attachment and stable social bonds. We need to be embraced by communities of care and nurture in which we are cherished even as the messy bundle of impulses that we are. Trauma leaves chaos in its wake. Gentle care affirms us as potential participants in societies of shared responsiveness to one another and to the good. The challenge facing rational animals is to form the passions such that they harmonize with reason's judgments. We thus need habits, virtues. Sometimes we need to recognize that our anger is excessive or misplaced, that we have not, in fact, been injured, that another's reprimand was justified, and that it is we and not they who should apologize and make amends. Sometimes we need to recognize that we have been blind or indifferent to some injustice, that we need to summon anger to assist us in working toward justice. That the passions come to be formed in harmony with reason's judgments does not mean that the passions become superfluous or that we would be better off without them. This would be to reject our specific good as rational animals. So it belongs to the perfection of the human good that our passions be moderated by reason. But it also belongs to the perfection of human good that we be moved to good, not merely by the will, not merely by the rational appetite that follows reason's judgment, but by the sensitive appetite. The fierce flame of anger is the other side of the tenderness of love, and both are the gift of feeling, not merely thinking, our judgments. To forget this is to wish away our embodied existence, to wish ourselves angels or some kind of AI. And this is to repudiate the goodness of the incarnation through which God assumed embodied existence together with the passions. God took upon God's self passions that allow God to feel as we do, to feel the evil of injustice at the core of our being, and equally to love in visceral ways that vibrate through our bodies. What God found so precious, we should not be quick to replace or abandon, however impressively superhuman the cognitive capacities of AI may become. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.